So yes, for the last few weeks we've been looking at this book, What is the Dharma? And studying some of the, or exploring some of the material in here. Last week, I think David Mitchell looked at a topic called The Texture of Reality, which was looking at our sort of conditioned world, which was impermanence, our sort of experience as impermanent, sort of lack, not having a fixed self, and unsatisfactory. So I think that's what he did last week. I wasn't here, but I think that's what he was exploring. So today we're going to be looking at nirvana. What is nirvana? So I think it's one of the most attractive words in Buddhism. It's very easy to say, sort of rolls off the tongue. And I personally, yeah, find it an attractive word. But I'm wondering how many of you sort of before tonight sort of, you know, familiar with that word. Just sort of show, yeah? And so all of you, great. So, and how many of you would say that you do also find a very attractive, appealing word? How many of you don't, are kind of indifferent or neutral about it? Yes, and how many of you actually, any of you sort of not have any sort of positive association? Okay, so I have a neutral, a few of you are neutral, but most of a kind of positive association. And I'm kind of interested in when I say the word nirvana, when you think the word nirvana, what images or feelings or thoughts are there? Anyone want to share what? Yeah.
The state of complete happiness and satisfaction.
Yeah, that sounds nice. State of complete happiness and satisfaction, yeah. Any others?
Heaven,
okay. You mean in the what sense?
In like a everything is amazing, bliss.
Okay, not angels and harps.
Not so much
okay.
angels.
Okay. Okay. Heavenly kind of state.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than a place called heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Any others?
Peaceful.
Peacefulness. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Warmth.
What?
Warmth.
Yeah, warmth. Nice, yeah. Any others?
Purity.
Okay. These are really nice words, aren't they? Yeah.
This is supposed to be the ultimate pure consciousness in which ultimate reality resides.
Ultimate pure consciousness in which ultimate reality resides. Yeah, great. Well, I mean, in a way, I mean, it's just nice hearing all those words. They sound really positive, and it certainly, begins to get us in the mood for exploring nirvana. So let's start with what the actual literal meaning is of the word, and it's a Sanskrit word with the and the Pali is nibbana. So the Sanskrit is nirvana, Pali is nibbana, and it literally translates as to blow out or extinguish. That's what the actual literal meaning is. So what is extinguished is that which creates our suffering. So traditionally, greed, hatred, and delusion, that's extinguished when you arrive at nirvana. So when I think of the word extinguish, I think of fire. That's an immediate association, isn't it? Fire. And I was thinking about, well, the image that came to my mind was of a forest. Maybe there's a few fires in the forest. Maybe they're not large fires. Maybe they're just in the, they're just there. But you know the thing about forest fires that they can spread very easily if left unattended. Yeah. So there's a few fires in the forest, and at a certain point, we begin to realise that we need to do something about it. Otherwise, it's going to spread and cause a lot of destruction. So we act, because we don't want that, we act. And you might get a few buckets, and try to put the fires out, maybe some hoses. We just do our best to put these fires out. But then a certain point comes where you think, oh, this is kind of hard work, right? I mean, I think it is, like, forest fires are hard work, from what I can gather. So you think, oh gosh, I don't know if I can actually do this. You know, am I going to be able to put this fire out? But then you look at the sky and the rain starts. And even though the rain's very light, there's a relief. There's a hope, isn't there? There's hope that if the rain continues to fall, the fire will eventually be quenched. And the rain does fall a bit heavier. The blaze is sort of tempered. It falls again, it falls more, and eventually the fire goes out. And it's a relief. You sort of realise that now, the forest is saved. The forest is saved, and new growth can happen. So the fires, the flames, are our passions, greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think most of the time we have those things we think we have them under control. You know, we sort of don't go around, you know, in full amounts of greed and in full amounts of hatred and in full amounts of delusion most of the time. But it doesn't take much, you know, an argument, being a bit stressed, anxious about something. It doesn't take much for sort of us to feel that kind of fire within. Yeah? I'm kind of just, hopefully I'm sort of speaking, not just my experience here. So we know that we can be triggered at any time, like a spark, and that flame can be triggered. So the Samyutta Nikaya is a Pali text, one of the very earliest Pali texts, sort of recording the voice of the Buddha, the historical Buddha. And in that he says, the extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion, this indeed is called nirvana. So the main way nirvana is described there is the absence of something. But instead of nothing replacing it, so you've got absence of those things, but instead of the absence of that, what you have is supreme bliss, supreme liberation. And they use the word supreme to really give us a sense that we're not talking about ordinary bliss, we're not talking about ordinary happiness or liberation. It's something beyond what we can normally experience. And nirvana was probably first spoken about when the historical Buddha gave his very first sermon, his very first teaching to the five ascetics. He was practicing with these ascetics and he left them to kind of pursue his enlightenment. And he went back to them once he attained enlightenment and gave them his first teaching. So let's just do a recap generally. So the Buddha to be, Siddhartha Gautama, was his name. So he leaves home and, you know, he leaves his status, his inheritance, his family, everything, goes off on this quest, has lots of sort of adventures, goes through a lot of difficulties as well, a lot of hardship. But, you know, he knows that there's something that lies beyond old age, sickness and death. He just knows there has to be. So he's really determined to find that. And a really pivotal moment comes after he's done his sort of periods of sort of hardship and asceticism. He realises that's not the way. And a really pivotal moment comes when he remembers as a child sitting under the apple tree. He remembers sitting under the apple tree, watching his father ploughing. And that sort of methodical movement of the plough. He's watching that, he's very relaxed, and he finds himself in a sort of concentrated state, a very sort of meditative state, and he enters sort of higher states of consciousness. And from that experience, when he remembers that, he realises that the truth and what he's looking for lies between two poles of experience. It lies between extremes. It lies between, discipline and enjoyment. It lies between calm and energy. It just lies between these opposites. He goes under the Bodhi tree with that knowledge, with a real intuitive sense of what he's looking for. And he's got nothing to lose. He's kind of already thrown everything at it, really. Nothing to lose, everything to gain. And he sits there. And he goes for this kind of epic journey. where and at the end of which he's not Siddhartha Gautama anymore. He's awakened. He's now the Buddha. And you get a sense, well, I get a sense when I think about that bit, is that he had a sense of what he was looking for. He had a sense of what some of the journey was, but actually what happened defied all his expectations. It was beyond what he could have conceived. So the experience was so profound, so radical, so dramatic, that it was just an unknown experience. So the person that emerges is no longer Siddhartha Gautama. It's this new being. And Sangha actually says, in a way, the Buddha was no longer a man in the ordinary sense of the way we normally think of people. So he hasn't, sort of, Siddhartha Gautama hasn't sort of gone through this experience and become a better version of himself. He's just altogether different. And it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about this and thinking, well, Siddhartha Gautama, you could trace, you know, about his family, you know, about his education. It's almost like you could trace his development, yeah? And you could trace all his experiences. With the Buddha, when he becomes the Buddha, it's like you can't track anything. You can't trace anything. He's got a completely different consciousness to what Siddhartha Gautama had. So that happens because of the enlightenment experience, because of the experience of nirvana. So this new being, this Buddha wants to share what he's discovered with us. And then we know that he has a moment of doubt when he thinks, how can I explain what I've been through and what I've seen and understood to people who haven't been on this journey that I've been on? But he also knows that we all have within us the sort of seed of enlightenment. He knows that. And he knows that if we're open enough, ready enough, we can sort of hear it. So he knows that. So he gives his first great sermon, as I said, to the four ascetics. And I try to imagine sometimes myself, like, meeting the Buddha, you know, this historical Buddha, and what that might have been like. I wouldn't have been one of the ascetics, I don't think, at all, matted hair and all that. I probably would have been the, you know, woman on the side with a shopping bag or something, going somewhere to the market. But I would have seen this figure sort of emanating this energy, this kind of powerful energy. And I would have also sort of felt a deep calm somehow, sort of a mixture of energy and calm. And I would have been really drawn in by that. And then when he looked at me, imagine he did, I think I would have just felt this real love somehow, just, you know, just this love coming from him. And I think I would have also thought, well, it's almost like he knows what I've been through, or he has a sense of what I've been through, and also sees my potential. So I can imagine that, you know, that sort of experience. And I imagine that the five ascetics, well, he did know them, or they knew him, and I imagine that they were, once they kind of realised he was something altogether different, I think they would have been very open to what he had to say. So the first thing he says is, he says something that we can all relate to instantly, and that is, life is unsatisfactory. It's suffering. And we can all relate to that, no matter where we're our starting point, we can all connect with that. And we would have, you know, I would have, and that if I was listening to that, I would have thought about all the times that things had been unsatisfactory. So he would have said that and I would have felt it. I would have said yes. And then he says that there's a cause of this suffering. So this is interesting because, you know, I think often we think, why don't things work out? Why does life feel difficult? Why are other people difficult, you know, irritating sometimes? Why can't things go smoothly? And then we might have all kinds of theories about it. In fact, the world is full of theories about why things don't work out. You know, politicians have their theories, and self-improvement development people have their theories. Everyone has their theory. But none of the theories stick, really. They don't hold to all situations. So when the Buddha says the reason we suffer is because of craving, in a way I think, gosh, that's almost simple. That's a really simple sort of response. And but we begin to ponder that. Well, is that true? Is that true that our suffering is to do with craving? So we kind of ponder that and we begin to realise there are times that when we have craved, and it takes all forms, it causes us problems. So we begin to see the truth there. And then we're thinking, well, I definitely, you know, by this time, you definitely know you suffer. That's absolutely true. You look at the world, and I just have to look at your own experience. You look at the world and you see it. And then you want to know, well, what next? Is that it? So when the Buddha then says, and the third noble truth is, there's an end to this suffering. And it's called nirvana. You hear that word. It's a relief. It's a revelation and a relief. So it doesn't have to be like this. You know, my experience doesn't have to be like this. So it's a real relief. And then he says a fourth noble truth is there's a path. There's something you can do to go from where you are, a state of suffering and unsatisfactoriness, to a state of complete, what was it? Complete rest and happiness, complete peace and happiness. And there's a path that takes us there. So, in a way, you think, well, yes, I don't know. You might think, I don't actually know if it's all absolutely true, but I know where I am now, and I know I want to move towards more happiness. So, you start meditating, you might go on retreat, you might, you know, start reading more about Buddhism. So, but the main thing, you start, you're ready. But there's a little warning here. So we have a little warning. And I've said that the Buddha wasn't an improved version of Siddhartha. He was a totally different being because of the experience of the enlightenment, nirvana. So nirvana is out of our normal frame of reference. It's beyond our words and concepts. So everything I say today, and probably most things you read about nirvana, it's hopefully orientating in a particular direction, but it's not the experience itself. It's not the truth itself. It's orientating us to be open to an experience of that sort of connects with that. But we can't describe it in words. And that also means that when we are sort of setting out on the path to nirvana, it's not like other paths. So normally, if you think, well, okay, I want to get fit, you'll, there's a whole thing, sequence of things you do. You sort of, you know, you go running or you sort of start eating healthily. If you want to, get a new job or climb the professional ladder, then you update your CV and you go on some training and you do your LinkedIn and all those kind of things. It's kind of like we know there's a whole load of things that we can do. And then when you think, well, I want to be happier, and there's this thing called nirvana, you could see that if you had you could think about having the similar approach. So you could think, right, okay, I'm not too happy at the moment. I want to be happier. So I'm going to really try and be happy. I'm going to be really positive. I'm going to really sort of try and see the bright side of things. I'm going to really make an effort to not get annoyed with my colleagues at work, you know, or whoever. And you really, really try. And at some point, it feels a bit of an effort, but you keep trying because you want to attain the state of happiness. So you keep trying, but it does feel hard because things are still not going the way you want them to go. People still can be a bit annoying. You still don't get what you want when you want it. So if you just kind of think, oh, and then you think, well, I don't know if this thing works. I'm not sure actually. Nirvana feels really out there, over there, unattainable. I don't think I can get it, especially in my circumstances and in my set of conditions. Is that familiar to anybody? So that approach to sort of arriving at nirvana doesn't tend to work. And Sangharakshita, in the chapter on nirvana, he says, no progress, as I'm quoting him here, no progress can be made till we come to terms with our actual experience. till we get to know our unhappiness in all its comings and goings, till we learn to live with it and study it. What is it at bottom that makes us unhappy? What is its source? So the first step at arriving at nirvana is knowing truly, understanding our unsatisfactory nature of our lives. So he goes on to say, nirvana consists in the full and complete awareness of why you want to reach nirvana at all. If you understand completely why you want to reach nirvana, then you've reached nirvana. So that's a kind of paradox. He's kind of putting that there for us to kind of ponder on, I think. But what I get from that is the first step of going in the direction of nirvana is stopping, pausing, going deeper, and coming to terms with where you are, where we are now. So Subhuti, who's the president of this centre, he sort of echoed this really. He does these series of rambles. He comes and sort of talks, and he's doing that in a couple of weeks' time, isn't he? So a few weeks' time. So definitely recommend that. So he was here last year, and he was talking about how we approach, you know, this nirvana, or he called it the unconditioned. So the first step, in a way, or the first way of approaching it, is looking at nirvana in a sort of a spatial sense. Okay, so we've got nirvana. If you think about nirvana as the vast blue sky, yeah, it's a vast blue sky, boundless. It's scintillating. It's dynamic. There's levels and layers of dimension in this blue sky. So that's nirvana. And then where we are, our conditioned way of relating to the world, that's called samsara. So samsara is, actually literal meaning means wandering, continually moving. So we've got nirvana, which is this vast blue sky, and then we've got samsara, which is our conditioned way of relating. So in a way, I think of it as, nirvana, samsara is contained within nirvana. So there's samsara, I've got a kind of sphere shaped here, and here's nirvana. So we arrive at, or we begin to arrive at nirvana, or at least experience it more, by relating or understanding samsara. Yeah? Because what we're doing here, we're this kind of, our experience of samsara, we see things as fixed, it's limited, it's confined. We have very fixed ideas about ourselves, very fixed ideas about other people. We think things are permanent, we think things are solid. So it's all quite sort of rigid in a way, and, you know, sort of contained. But the more we explore our experience, and we've been looking at that over the weeks, the more we explore our experience, the more we see, actually, are things fixed? Are things permanent? We begin to see that they're not. We begin to see that I am a flow of conditions. You know, I came about through various conditions coming together. My experience of my day is various conditions coming together. This chair is various conditions coming together. So we begin to kind of realize that things are not the way we see things. And we begin to see beyond the fixed boundaries that we've created in our minds. And from that, our vision, our view of things begins to expand. We see more of ourselves and we can see more of other people because we're not confining and containing everybody in a very particular view. So, yeah. So we're basically able to get from by exploring the conditioned in this way, by exploring samsara in this way, we begin to see beyond it. We begin to access more what this bigger space could be. So let me pause there and see if there's any immediate questions. Yeah.
So actually, the road to Nirvana, like you described, if I want to get healthy, I'm going to go to the gym, start running. I want to get to Nirvana, I'm going to start understanding samsara.
Yeah.
Now, what would be the best way to understand samsara? Is it just me sitting down and reflecting on things, or should I be reading books? Should I be... That's my question.
Okay.
What would be the best way?
The quickest way?
Yes.
The best way.
I want to get there already.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So... I think all of the things you've said. So meditation is key. So we have the threefold path. Yeah. So there's meditation, ethics, and wisdom. And that's just those just three methods are just very simple. So in a way, it's one to remember. So with meditation, what you're doing, you're stopping, you're examining your experience. You're also cultivating qualities as well, and you're actually getting to grips with your conditioning. Because we've come with so much conditioning, we've come with so much, well, you could call it, you know, baggage, but really it's just various things, you know, come with so much views of who we are and what the world's about. So actually just meditate and you begin to examine that, explore it, see what's real, what's not real. So that's a very important thing. And then ethics, in a way, what we're doing, by practicing ethics, we're actually just... beginning to live in a way that's going to help us see things more clearly. Because the more we, it's a bit like the, and I'll talk about this in a bit, but in a way it's a bit like the forest fire. We're often making more fires. We're putting more logs to, you know, onto it, adding a bit of petrol here and there, because we, you know, and actually what that's doing is we're basically creating more confusion for ourselves, more hatred. So actually practicing ethics enables us to just dwell much more in positive states of mind. And then study, reading, talking about the Dharma with others who are also practicing the Dharma is also really important. Because again, what we have ideas, we bring all kinds of ideas to our experience. So when you're talking with others, you're beginning to unpack your experience a little bit and actually explore, well, again, what's my conditioning? What's my conditioned response on what actually is the truth. Yeah?
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I think through service to others, through dedicating your life to others,
yes.
It's like, I think it's one of the fastest way, if obviously you're dedicated. There's no such a thing of expectations,
yeah.
Just unconditional giving.
Yeah. Absolutely, and that is really, in a way, the more you're able to see the limits of your understanding, the how fixed you can view the world, and the more you cultivate qualities, the more you're able to respond to others. And then there's a whole thing of service. You know, once you see that others are suffering, and you see the human condition, you want to do something about that. You realise it doesn't have to be like that. So yes, you want to help others. And in a way, it's a you grow through that as well. Yeah. So thanks for that.
I find the translation of samsara into wandering very interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Because it's funny, because I've always associated wandering with exploration, with discovery. And I mean, even the Buddha, you know, his attainment of enlightenment came after he'd been wandering for, you know, I don't know actually how long, but you know, it came, you know, he had to go wandering in order for that to happen. So one thing that I find difficult is this notion of a path. And that the path is, you know, the path is the way that we, you know, that we come to nirvana, whereas wandering is samsara, when that doesn't necessarily seem to have been the case for the Buddha.
So when I think of a Buddha, you know, in a way you could say, yeah, he went wandering, but I guess I don't see it like that, because I think the Buddha was very clear about what he was doing. So when I guess the connotation for wandering in this sense is a sort of wandering, and it's not necessarily of a really strong purpose. So we can wander, we can sort of go through our life experiences, and we learn a bit of this, and you know, we do a bit of that, and we accumulate, we do the things we think we should be doing, but it's not necessarily with a very strong, actually, this is what I'm ultimately trying to achieve, yeah? And it's only when things don't work out, we think we know, but actually, it's usually when things don't work out, I think, how comes this didn't work out? What is my life about? Where am I really going? So I see that as wandering. It's kind of like you go from one experience to another, to another, to another. You learn what you can, but it's you don't necessarily know where it's taking you. Mm. Whereas what the Buddha did was he was on a quest. He was very clear what his objective was. Mm. He had to go through certain experiences, but as soon as he realized his experiences weren't, some of the experiences weren't helping him, he dusted himself down, you know, found the next thing. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
He was very clear on what he was looking for. Mm. So in a way, that's why it's important, I think, to have a goal in this sense, a kind of aim, because that helps us, we kind of orientate in ourselves. It's like a compass. And we can get a sense, well, actually, am I going in the right direction? I'm wanting, you know, to develop happiness, freedom. Is my experiences leading me contentment? And what I'm doing leading me there or not? And then when it isn't, we can then, you know, readjust. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's food for thought.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So Subhuti talks about three different ways of approaching the unconditioned. And as I said, one is a spatial way, to look at it spatially, as I've just done. Big blue sky, nirvana, samsara, the conditioned, sort of within nirvana. The second way is to approach it in a temporal way. So here, so we've got samsara, so here, and nirvana is there, and we want to go from one to the other, and it takes time. So there's a sequence of steps. It's a bit like what you were asking, well, how do I do it? So there's a sequence of steps that need to happen, and it will take time to get from one to the other. And what we're really doing there is creating the conditions whereby, you know, we can get closer to nirvana and sort of further away from samsara. So these analogies start to kind of, they're not sort of all perfect, these analogies. But in a way, when we get sort of further from samsara, we're actually seeing samsara much more clearly as well, yeah? It's a bit like what Bhante was saying, in a way, the more you understand why nirvana. So in a way, when we kind of really understand samsara, really understand it, we realise the need for nirvana, yeah? But there's all these sequence of steps and the conditions that we need to bring about in order to get there. So that's all the things I said about study, practicing, ethics, friendships, etc. Also, as we're doing that, our momentum grows. So the more we're sort of orientating ourselves in that way, our sort of confidence in it grows, because we're having glimpses of it as we go along. So we get to sense, well, actually, it's not unattainable completely, because we're getting that feedback. That it's working. So that's really important as well. And the third way Subhuti talks about is a bit more mysterious. And that is where the unconditioned or nirvana moves towards us. So let's go back to the image of the fire in the forest. Because we see the fire, we see it's all in flames, we're not ignoring it anymore. We're not hoping it just sorts itself out somehow. We know we need to take action. So we're taking action. We've got our buckets, we've got our hoses, etc., etc. You do realise that in some ways you've been adding to the fire all this time too. So you're no longer doing that. That's practicing ethics. Yeah, you're no longer adding to the fire. And, well, it's having an effect. You're seeing that the, you know, it's the flames are reducing. You're seeing that. And at the same time, there are going to be times when you think, oh, I'm not, can I do this? It just feels so vast. The forest is big. The flames are high. You're thinking, can I do this? But you keep making the effort because you can see it is working as well. But you just have moments of doubt or times when you just think, actually, I'm not sure I can do this by myself. So, but then, of course, the rain comes. And it's come as if from nowhere. And, well, you can't believe it, really, because it's almost like your deepest prayers have been answered. You know, you're making all this effort, you know, and it was helping. But then this rain comes. And it's like, oh, you know, you've got the help that you needed. So this can happen in lots of different ways, the sort of unconditioned or nirvana moving towards us, lots of different ways. It might be by reading a book. You know, you might be flicking through a book and suddenly there's a paragraph in it that just says exactly what you need to get you, you know, to the next step or to get you clear or to resolve the dilemma that you've been in or the suffering that you've been feeling. It might be simple as that. Or it might be a meditation experience that you have. You know, you're sitting to meditate and you're a bit distracted and then you sort of find yourself, might be on retreat, they're always good places for these things. And then within a few minutes, suddenly you're no longer distracted, you're in a completely different space. And you're seeing things so much more clearly than you ever have. It might be a friend just saying to you, oh, I'm popping along to the London Buddhist Centre, I'm going to go meditate. And you think, London Buddhist Centre, what's that? And next thing you know, you'll find yourself here. So in all kinds of ways, and I remember before I came to meditate, I was really searching. I was really looking for something. And in a state of real frustration, because I felt like I knew that life was suffering. I knew that the things that held meaning for me no longer did. And I didn't know how to live anymore, really. I thought, I don't know how to go about my day because all the things that everyone else, all the other students were into, I was no longer into. And I was into it like a few months before, and suddenly I wasn't. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I was at the top of these stairs, and I was with a friend, and I was telling her about it. And I was actually saying, look, I can't even communicate with people anymore. I want deeper communication. And every time I want to talk about these things, people were not interested. And she was really kind as she listened to me. But she didn't quite know what I was talking about either. And as we were talking, people were going up and down these stairs. And I just looked up and saw this guy walking up the stairs. And there was nothing, people had been going up all the time that we had been talking. But I saw that, I noticed this particular guy. And I don't know why I particularly noticed him, I just did. So he walked up to the top of the stairs. And I sort of watched him. And he put some leaflets on the table where we were, and there were loads of leaflets on the table, and I watched him walk back down the stairs, and I went and picked up the leaflet that he put down, and it said, Creative Communication Workshops, Bristol Buddhist Centre. I thought, Creative Communication Buddhist, it's like those three words just jumped out at me. And really the rest was history. So that was definitely something moving towards me at a time when I needed it most. So there are things that sort of burst through our everyday normal experience. And it might be, as I said, those kind of things. It might be actually sitting with a friend or relative who's dying or very sick. It's like truth is communicating itself to you. If we're open to it. So it can happen at any point. So, I want to sort of share a dream with you. And I'm hoping it sort of pulls some of what we've talked about together. And then we might have some time for questions as well. So in this dream, I had this dream about about 4 to 5 years into me practicing, meditating. I was committed, I would say. So I was living with other Buddhists. I was meditating every day. But in my own life, I was very busy. I was studying, I was working part-time, so I was, had a lot of, you know, thinking about essays and that kind of thing, and caught up in a few dramas in my life. So, you know, yes, I was committed, and I had a lot going on as well. And I went to, I would say I was still figuring myself out a lot, you know, it's just sort of really coming to terms with what I brought, what you know, really my background, my conditioning and all of that. Anyway, one day, I think I went to bed thinking about my next essay, and then I had this dream. So I'm going to describe it in the present, and I would say that the dream really came from nowhere. It was like the rain in the forest, and it felt like a gift at the time. It still does. So this is a dream. So I'm walking across a bridge. It's a wooden low bridge, and it stretches far into the distance. So it's a bit cold, so I'm a little bit tense, but not in a big way, just that sort of level of, you know, tension you can have when it's a bit cold. And on my left is a grey sky. It's a big sky, but it's completely grey. There's like nothing happening in the sky. It's very static, quite monotonous. So I'm looking at this sky, and then I'm looking at the bridge ahead of me. The bridge seems to just stretch really far in the distance. I can't actually see the end of this bridge. So I'm looking at this bridge, looking at the sky, and then eventually I notice I've got this pain in my neck. I notice it, but I realise it's been there all the time, actually, this pain. So I'm feeling this pain. It's partly because my neck is positioned in an awkward way when I look to the left. So I'm looking, I've got this pain, and sometimes it's just a really dull sort of ache. It's not sort of terrible, but it's there. And then every now and again, it becomes a really sharp pain, and I'm sort of, ow, you know, really, really, really hurts. But anyway, that's how it is, and I carry on walking across this bridge. The bridge doesn't get any shorter, still very long. The sky is still very grey, it's very monotonous. But I kind of want something from the sky. I'm waiting for something to happen, but you know, it's nothing really is happening. But I'm looking within, you know, something to happen. So I carry on walking, and I get really familiar with this rhythm, with the rhythm of me walking across this bridge, the pain in my neck, the position, the awkward position of my neck, and sometimes the pain's very dull. Sometimes it recedes, and I completely forget about it. And sort of get interested in the sky again, and then it gets sharp. So this is just going on and on and on and on. And I don't know how long this bit of the dream was, because it just felt like a very, very long, very long time. And I get very familiar with it all. And then I realise, like, oh, is this it? Is this it? Is this my life? Is this looking at this grey sky with this pain in my neck, slightly cold, walking across this long bridge that seems to never end? Is this it? I don't actually want it to be just this. But actually, it's all I know. And then I hear a voice. And the voice says, turn to the right. And I'm like, the right? There's a right? So that's like a completely new concept to me. And I carry on walking across this bridge and looking to the left, the pain coming and going. I'm not actually sure I want to turn anywhere. I'm kind of used to it. I'm used to this. The sky. I'm still waiting for something to happen in this sky. I'm used to this bridge. I'm used to the cold. It's kind of what I know. So I just carry on walking. Then the voice comes again. It's very calm, and it's very encouraging, and it's very warm. Turn to the right. And I sort of hesitate. I carry on walking, but I hesitate, and I think, what's going to happen if I turn to the right? I'm not sure that's what I want. Will I have to give up the left? Because it's not so bad, really, is it? Pain isn't always there. So I carry on walking, and then it gets sharp. I feel that really awful, sharp pain. But the same rhythm, same sky, same interminable bridge, same awkward position, same tension, same cold. So is this really all there is? There just has to be more. What is on the right? And will it ease my pain? So I realise I'm afraid. But then I also know, well, what's there to lose? You know, I can always turn back. What's there to lose? So finally I stop. I stop walking. I stop wandering down this bridge. And I'm with my breath, so I'm breathing. And I turn my head slowly to the right. And I'm enveloped by warm sunlight, by oranges and deep yellows, and it's this pulsating, dynamic experience. There's an interplay, there's a communication going on. I'm part of it all. My body's still here, but I'm part of this whole bigger experience now. It's deeply calm, rich, fulfilling. It's an ongoing expanse, and it goes on forever, and I feel complete. I'm no longer driven by anything, and I'm not reaching for something or looking for something else. It's deeply peaceful and fulfilling. So I turn my head back, except the bridge is gone, and there's no left and there's no right. Everything has changed and nothing has changed. So that's the end of the dream. So I woke up and I felt completely different. So like all dreams like that, there were lots of levels and layers to it. But the first thing that struck me upon waking was how I was with that pain in my neck. That was the first thing that struck me. Because I realised, I thought, gosh, even though it was causing me so much suffering ongoingly, I didn't want to let it go. I sort of held on to it. It took me so long to do something different. There was so sort of much resistance there, in a way. And I had to go through that whole process of walking and thinking and wondering and looking for something else before I listened to the voice that was there. And then I did turn, and, well, happiness came. And time and space also disappeared. And everything was okay. So in the dream, there is this path, and there's a way of looking at experience. In a way, that's what was happening. I was looking at experience in a particular way that was causing pain. But it's what I knew. It's all I knew at that stage. And Nirvana, if you like, that voice was calling me, and really all I had to do was change my perception, and then everything changed. So yeah, that's the end of the dream. And yes, any final questions?
Yeah, did you manage to turn to the right? Realize?
Mm.
Whatever that
I feel like I'm continually in that experience, in a way, you know, that samsara, understanding conditions, the conditioned nature of experience, the first noble truth, the second noble truth, are inquiries that, you know, still are still very much going on, yeah? Because they're very deep, very profound inquiries. And at the same time, there's been, for me, enough glimpses of the unconditioned or of what that's trying to communicate that I feel like I'm heading in the right direction, yeah? So my confidence in that grows and grows the more I practice. Yeah. And the other part of your question was?
My other, you basically answered the
okay.
same question.
Okay, right.
There's a bit related to the story you told, your experience standing on the stairs talking to your friend, because that's a bit how I feel right now.
Mm.
And then your dream right now helped me kind of answer my own question, but what advice would you give to a person if they're still waiting for that man to drop the leaflet or for the voice to tell you to turn right? Is it just waiting? Because according to your dream, it wouldn't be just wandering and waiting.
No.
It would be doing something about it, but what?
Yeah. So it's sort of... in a way, it's kind of the things we talked about earlier with the forest and the flames, in a way. It's kind of like if there's a state of confusion or upset, you know, meditation. You know, that's one thing that we're doing to kind of understand our experience more, to bring some, to cultivate those qualities, to cultivate clarity of mind so we can see our situation more clearly. Ethics, practicing ethics. And then obviously learning more about the Dharma. So those are all things available to you now. And then, in a way, what we're doing there, we're creating the conditions for something else then to come into being. We can't force growth, you know. We can't force those experiences that then come. So we can't force them because they're sort of beyond us in a way. But what we're doing, we're creating those conditions whereby when they're there, the opportunities are there, we're open and receptive. Yeah?
Yeah.
So does that help?
Yeah.
And I would say also it's very important. I think what I didn't have in that when I was really frustrated was other people to speak to, you know, who were following the same path, following the path I wanted to. It's like that was really important for me that I met other people that were on the same journey. Yeah.
Where do you think the voice is coming from? Do you feel like it was something that was coming from inside, so something that you already knew, or is it something that you'd heard from a friend or from like your practice, and it was something that you'd heard, but not it was coming out from your subconscious?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it?
Just from, I don't know.
It's quite mysterious.
Some kind of energy,
I
don't know. Where was it?
So that's the sort of the unconditioned moving towards us. And it is mysterious. And I wouldn't be able to say, oh, it was coming from me. You know, I've had other experiences like that. And that each time I can't think, oh, that was just me. That was just me being really positive. It doesn't feel like that at the time. And at the same time, I am also aware that I have created certain conditions that where those things happen and I am really open. So there's a sort of like a level of receptivity, a level of faith. But when those things come, I really see it and embrace it. And so I can't say whether it's in or out. I really can't say that. And in a way, that whole sort of dualistic sort of thinking, I mean, that's why we think, isn't it? We think left and right, we think in or out, we think self and other. We have this whole sort of way of thinking about our experience. And what these kind of experiences show, I think, well, I was open to that. I was certainly needing something like that. So I sort of brought it, some of it, you know, some of it must have come from me, but something was outside of that as well. What I also know is that I've got the seed, we all have the seed of enlightenment within me. You know, we all have that. So in a way, when that is evoked or, you know, sort of you're connected to that, then in a way you might be more able to recognize that going on elsewhere. Yeah?
I'm quite new here, yeah. So it's an easy question, but how do you cope with doubt? Because it's really beautiful thing to really genuinely have faith in that everything can follow this path, but there are bound to be obstacles that you face, or people that challenge you about it. And I was just wondering how do you cope with that doubt?
Yeah, it's difficult when you, if you really sincerely want to follow a path, and particularly if no one else around you are, and they think you're, what are you doing? They can't see, is that the situation? They can't see, they can't see what it's about. So it is difficult, and I think, again, it goes back to actually making sure that you are in contact with people who do see and do understand and can affirm your, you know, decisions and can help you think about what the next step is for you. And it's amazing as well how if you continue with your own conviction, because there's something, you know, is responding, and if you can sort of, you know, stay with that with support from others, it's amazing that sometimes the doubters or the people or the situations that, you know, feel like they're not supporting us, sometimes they just change, as if, you know, just by us following our truth. It's quite interesting. I just, a little story of when I started meditating. My mum is a Christian, so I'd go back home and be upstairs sort of meditating when I was younger, and she really found it so deeply challenging. I mean, she really hated the idea of me doing something like that. So she'd put the Hoover on. And she'd kind of hoover and come into the room and hoover. And I was like, okay, what would the Buddha do? So I really had to just, okay, now I'm not going to react. I really practice. But I did carry on. You know, it was kind of like, actually, this is my path. And I need to make decisions for myself. And, you know, I'll make mistakes. Probably, but there's people around me who hopefully will understand, and, you know, I've just got to live my life. It's really like, this is my life, actually. So I just carried on, and then, months later, I was meditating again when I went back home, and, you know, she put the Hoover on. She didn't come in the room, though, this time. She was just, like, hoovering outside the room. And then, you know, a few months later, she only hoovered downstairs. And then a few months later, my sisters were in as well, and I was meditating, and I heard her go, shh, she's meditating. And I just think it's because she saw that I was becoming a kinder, better person, and she didn't know why, how it worked or anything like that. She wasn't going to become a Buddhist, but she thought whatever she's doing, she seems happier. So in a way, it's like following your own truth, and the truth will speak for itself, and getting the support as well. Okay,
Is it something that can be taken from you? Because obviously life changes drastically for anyone, no matter who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it something that you can reach and then it leave you?
So it's called the unconditioned because it's not dependent on conditions. So all what you just said about anything can happen at any time and things, that is our experience, isn't it? We have something really positive going on for us, then something happens and it changes, and we things are not so positive anymore. But with the experience of enlightenment, that is not the case. You've kind of gone beyond the conditioned, yeah? So it's said to be a permanent state, but I'm not. I think it's more that it's outside of our concept of time and space, the way we normally think of time and space. I think that's what, in that sense, it's permanent, not in the sense of permanent in our normal frame of reference. And last question, I think. Did you have a question? No, you're all right. Okay, yeah.
There's a small contradiction that's bothering me. On one hand, in order to live the conditioned, we must detach ourselves from even wanting self-pleasure and self-pain. We gotta detach from wanting. pursuit of happiness. Now the instinct, when we think about nirvana, is I'm going to pursue this. But my question is, as long as, let's say, I decide to practice Buddhism and meditation in order to pursue nirvana, am I not doing a counteraction? As long as I pursue happiness, I will never find happiness. As long as I pursue nirvana, I won't reach nirvana, but it's the contrary. I must detach myself from even wanting nirvana.
So hang on. So you said that the you've got to detach yourself from pleasurable.
From wanting pleasure, from all the conditional things that I want, I got to detach myself.
So I wouldn't. That's not the premise that I think is necessarily the most helpful one to start with. Because if you're thinking I've got to detach oneself from pleasure or things that you want, it's kind of denial, isn't it, in a way? And what the Buddha, that's why that experience of the Buddha's under the tree was very important, because he said you're trying to find the middle way. You're not trying to do denial and denying your pleasures and denying all the things you want and indulgence. You're trying to find the middle way, yeah? So that's a really important starting point. Because anything, actually, yeah, well, I want a good job and whatever it is you want to get fit, that's all fine. That's all fine. As long as you're trying to practice ethics and meditation, then in a way, you're exploring yourself, you're exploring your conditioning. That is the next step, yeah? So try not to think of it as denial. That's really important. It's a short answer to that.
Okay.
Was there another bit of that question?
The second part is, would going into meditation in pursuit of happiness is not the wrong attitude? Or going into meditation and this kind of lifestyle in pursuit of reaching nirvana, is that not the wrong attitude?
It's not. I wouldn't say it's a wrong attitude. What I would say is we start from where we are. So we have an intention. We want to be happier. I think, does anyone want to be happier? Everyone on this planet wants to be happier. So in a way, yes, if that's your, that's a motivation, that's fine. But we also start from where we are. We can't impose happiness on our experience. So we start from where we are. We understand when what Bhante said to Sangwachi, that what is our causes of our unhappiness. That might be where our starting point is. And through that, you begin to untangle oneself from the things that are causing you to be unhappy, the things that are causing you to feel held back. You begin that process of untangling, to seeing more clearly, and from that, then you get glimpses of happiness. Yeah?
Okay.
Good. All right. That's our time. Thank you very much. See you next week.